podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
The development of advanced therapy medicinal products, or ATMPs, such as gene therapies and biologic and tissue engineer products, takes place in an ever-evolving landscape of groundbreaking science and rapid industry innovation, and is associated with unique clinical manufacturing and regulatory challenges. The Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research,
CBER, is the FDA center responsible for assuring the safety and effectiveness of biological products, including vaccines, allergenic products, blood and blood products, and cellular tissue and gene therapies, the ATMPs.
Dr. Peter Marks joined FDA as Deputy Center Director for CBER in 2012 and became Center Director in 2016. I am Alberto Grignolo, Editor of the IA Global Forum. Today, I welcome Dr. Marks as he shares his insights on the regulatory challenges of these and other scientifically advanced therapies. Dr. Marks, thank you very much for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First, Dr. Marks, from your point of view as a regulator,
what does or can FDA do to help overcome limitations in manufacturing of ATMPs?
This area of advanced therapy medicinal products is just an incredibly exciting one to be working in right now. It does, though, with all of the excitement, does present clinicians, manufacturers, and regulators with a set of challenges that they have not faced in exactly the same way previously. In part, I think that's because the science is evolving so rapidly, and it's evolving at such a rapid pace that it's hard for the technology to keep up with it. And what I mean by that is that we have gene therapy techniques in the laboratory that have developed, and yet the technology, the manufacturing technology, the product characterization technologies have struggled to keep pace with those. So I think that is one of the challenges on the manufacturing side. And then if we turn to the clinical and the regulatory side, there are new challenges that we're facing as we enter this era of individualized therapies. And what I mean by individualized as opposed to personalized is personalized medicine is when we took things off the shelf after finding a characteristic, a biomarker in a patient that showed something that indicated that one of those medicines on the shelf might make a beneficial difference in that person's treatment. Now we're thinking about understanding what the patient's disease is and then designing the medicine specifically for them, the gene therapy or the cell-based gene therapy. And the issue there is that now we're into really a new territory where we're thinking about products that will be really only used in a few patients. And that leads to challenges in how you go ahead and manufacture them, characterize them, and even how you determine whether they're being effective. So it becomes a new paradigm that we have to start to think about as we move forward.
If I could reference a comment that I heard a former FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, make in public a couple of years ago, he said something to the effect that actually showing clinical efficacy may be a lot easier than managing the manufacturing issues associated with ATMPs.
Does that resonate? Would you agree with that? Has the world moved since those 2 years ago?
I think Dr. Gottlieb's comments are still as true today as they were 2 years ago, and that is that when a product is well conceived in this space to address particularly those products that are addressing single gene defects, oftentimes it's not a matter of whether the demonstration of efficacy becomes reasonably straightforward, especially if there's some natural history in the disease that we understand. It is understanding we will make the product reproducibly and in high quality where a lot of the effort has to go into. And I think that's actually exactly where this challenge is, because the investigators in laboratories are coming up with gene therapy constructs faster than we can turn them out in a good manufacturing practice grade manner to treat patients.
So that is an ongoing challenge in your perspective.
Indeed.
FDA, of course, is fully committed to supporting the development of advanced therapy medicinal products for the benefit of patients, including those that suffer from devastating, even rare diseases. What does FDA do? What can FDA do to help facilitate product development of ATMPs?
We have at least two levers that we'll try to pursue in this area. One is applied scientific research that we do at FDA. and the other is how we go about doing regulatory policy in this area. As for the applied scientific research, although it's not widely known often, we have research laboratories that conduct applied scientific research internally here at FDA, and they're focused, some of them are focused on how one can both produce and characterize these products more efficiently and in a more modern manner. They don't do basic research. They do applied research on how you might make products better. That's one way we do this. We also have, along the scientific research end, we have some grants and some contracts that we put out to help foster development in these areas. That is, look at better manufacturing methods, look at whether continuous manufacturing might be a solution in some cases, as one example. So we do this applied scientific research, but complementary to that, and very importantly, we have our regulatory policy efforts, and those include developing a framework that allows manufacturers of gene therapies, large and small, to find a way forward. So, for instance, we have guidance that we develop for gene therapies that are being used in moderately large size patient populations, as well as currently we're looking into how to develop the regulatory policy for these smaller populations, like the one I just described. For instance, this issue of how will we have regulatory policy that facilitates the production, the study, and ultimately facilitating the availability of products that will treat one or a few individuals. And so we are working on those things. And those are, it's very important how we think about those things. So in that area of these individualized products, we're working off of concepts of how one could look at a product that is well-defined and has a well-defined manufacturing process, which would be in like an originator product, and how one could then use and work off of that product as one makes changes to reference that and to largely use the process for the originator product for a new product, which we would call something like an offshoot product. So the idea here is trying to overcome some of these challenges in what will be these relatively individualized therapies in some cases, as well as to facilitate the manufacture and development of the products that will be for larger populations.
Thank you. If I may take us a little bit global, meaning internationally, again, we're staying with ATMPs.
Are there any ongoing or planned regulatory harmonization or regulatory convergence initiatives between FDA and other regulatory agencies, such as, for example, Health Canada, the European Medicines Agency, PMDA in Japan, NMPA in China, or others?
So that's a really great question because it's one that we've been very active in. So we're actively engaged with EMA, Health Canada, PMDA in Japan, and with those more advanced regulatory bodies, we're trying to develop convergence of our policies. I don't know that in the next year or two we're going to come to perfect harmonization, but as we speak with our colleagues, we're trying to find ways to minimize the need for companies to have to meet different regulatory standards in these different developed areas. But in these high-income countries, we hope that we can come to a convergence here on some of the key aspects of what's necessary. One outcome of this already has been the willingness of FDA to have the other foreign regulators on calls that we have with sponsors, provided that the sponsor is agreeable to it, or provided the sponsor initiates it, regarding early regulatory meetings. So we have a very early type of regulatory meeting called an interact meeting, which is even prior to the first formal regulatory submission. In the past, those have only been attended by the U.S. regulators and the companies, and we're now making it open so that a company, if they like, can have any other regulator join in those meetings so they can listen in. And for that matter, we're amenable to that type of an approach to other regulatory meetings that we have. So that's the first step in trying to help harmonize here, because the FDA is a little bit unusual among global regulators in that we get involved very early in product development and we stay involved right out through past when a product is on the market. So I think it allows the other regulators to benefit off of hearing those conversations. And I would say on the more
please,
global basis, we are engaged with the World Health Organization, because there we think that it's very important to start to pave the way for these advanced therapy medicinal products in places where they have not traditionally been studied, but where they will eventually be used, or where they may actually turn out be most impactful, and that is in low and middle income countries, because you can imagine that in certain places in India, Africa, other low and middle income countries where there are certain diseases for which the standard of care currently is nowhere near the standard of care in high income countries, the introduction of a gene therapy could be really transformational and save lives. And so we feel like it's important to start to introduce those countries to the regulatory framework that would be needed. And so we are actually meeting with groups of regulators in Geneva over the coming months to try to put together essentially what will be a white paper to help countries that are starting to put together their own regulatory frameworks.
That's very interesting. So cell and gene therapy could reach developing countries sooner rather than later through this mechanism, this collaboration with WHO and other bodies. Is that what you're saying?
I think what we're trying to do is help it get there faster than it would otherwise if we did not take action now, to help familiarize them with what a country would need to do to understand these, and also familiarize the regulators there so people might be more accepting of what these potentially could bring as they become available.
Are some of these regulatory harmonization or convergence activities happening within the realm of ICH, for example, or the ICMRA that might lead to maybe ICH guidelines in this regard?
We're beginning to start to consider what might be guidelines in this area. I think ultimately within several years, we will see ICH guidelines, but it may still be a little bit early for guidelines in some of these areas because the science is evolving so quickly. I think there's a little bit more convergence needed before we can put things down in the ways that International Conference on Harmonization likes to put things down, which is a pretty rigorous process that takes usually a few years. Right now, things are evolving so quickly that I think by the time we agree on anything, it would be almost out of date. So I agree with you. It may be important to get there, and it is important to get there, but that may be a few years down the road.
The world is moving faster than ICH can keep up with it, more or less.
I would say in this area, it's nothing against ICH. It's about the fact that the development here is just almost breathtakingly quick. Just think about very simple things that we now take for granted, like CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing. We talk about it all the time. Before 2012, it didn't exist. And now we have products that are being conceived of using this technology as the integral way they're going to genome edit. And when you think about it, it really didn't even come into significant use in these products until 2 or 3, 4 years ago. So you can see how fast things are moving here.
Before we leave this particular topic, could I ask you to please tell us a bit more about Interact so our listeners have a clear understanding of what those meetings are about and when they should be used?
The Interact program was started at the Center for Biologics to replace a type of meeting we used to have called a pre-IND meeting. The point of the Interact meeting is that it is an informal interaction. The discussion that happens is non-binding with the sponsor. It's generally for when a sponsor has a specific product that they intend to move forward into development, but they may not have actually started either the preclinical work or the manufacturing work or the clinical development, and they have questions about how they might proceed. They may not be advanced enough to be ready for a formal pre-IND meeting, and they'd like perhaps to get some more information about perhaps what preclinical data would be required or what type of manufacturing requirements they might need to adhere to. And what this enables the sponsor to do, the product developer, is to just write a couple of pages. It doesn't have to be a big formal regulatory submission, just a couple of pages with a few questions that they're interested in having answered. And then we'll schedule a meeting. Those meetings are held. It allows for a dialogue that can answer those questions. In some cases, we just respond in writing if the questions are very clear. I think it's a nice opportunity to get early advice that can avoid essentially spending time going down the wrong pathway before coming in for further regulatory interactions.
Is this Interact meeting a non-official meeting that doesn't generate official minutes?
So the important thing to understand is that although you may get back a letter with this, it's not a formal regulatory meeting. So the most important thing for sponsors to understand is that anything we say is non-binding. So we won't hold you to it. We'll tell you our best answers to questions, but But the information that we give you, if we tell you to do something in a given way, it's simply a suggestion. It's not binding. You don't have to do it. And we don't hold it against anyone if they decide to go a very different direction than the way we've told them.
And equally, anything the sponsor says at their meeting is also not binding. Fair enough?
That's fair enough. Exactly.
While FDA plays no official role in the pricing or reimbursement of ATMPs, is it discouraging and perhaps even frustrating for a regulator to approve a new ATMP only to find that its price in the market is well beyond the reach of the patients that need it? Maybe overreaching here, and you may not want to answer, but I wanted to ask you this question.
It's a fair question. What we see right now are products that are coming along that are so transformational that it's hard to get too frustrated about the pricing because they're making such a difference in lives. I think when you think about the recently approved product for spinal muscular atrophy type 1, which transforms this into, this is a transformational product. You had children who were dying, and now you have children who are living and essentially having basically normal childhood lives that was not possible before. It's hard for us at FDA to spend a lot of time getting disturbed about the pricing. That being said, I think we're very aware of the ultimate problem here, which is that if we have a whole host of million-dollar plus therapies that are coming out, that will actually be essentially limiting the ability of gene therapies and cellular therapies to make an impact. So our thinking about this is really that it's a twofold strategy. The strategy that we have, the levers that we have at FDA are, number one, trying to approve more products, because that would help, obviously, market competition is a good thing. And the other lever we have is to try to help improve the manufacturing, because the cost of goods with the development of cell and gene therapies is significantly higher relative to the price of many of these products. And the idea would be if you could bring down the cost of manufacture of these, the cost of goods, that that might also help things. If we could see more efficient vector manufacturing and gene therapy, or more automation in cell therapy production, more efficient production, that would be helpful. We're committed to using our levers, which, although granted, they're not directly impacting price, I think ultimately indirectly, hopefully will benefit.
Thank you for answering the question. It seems like the answer or a way to approach this is a combination of advanced technologies, manufacturing, as you mentioned, and market forces. As FDA approves more of these products, there would be more competition out there with the anticipated effects on pricing.
That summarized beautifully. Thank you.
Before we close, I'd like to ask you, are there any other topics you'd like to discuss today?
And I have to say, I'm interested in perhaps any comments you might have on these 7 new gene therapy guidances that you published in early 2020, in January, in fact.
Your last question, actually, and this one, actually run in very nicely, because the idea of these gene therapy guidances, there are 6 final guidance and 1 draft guidance. The final guidances, 3 of them are relatively specific for different clinical areas, hemophilia, retinal diseases, and rare diseases. And 3 of them have to do with more general topics like chemistry manufacturing controls, replication competent retroviral testing, and long-term follow-up. Those are hoped to give the field some more certainty so that it will be easier to move products forward. The draft guidance that we put out, it's a draft guidance on orphan sameness. And just to back up to explain that, obviously drugs that have orphan status, that is, that are applicable to populations of less than 200,000 in size in the United States, get certain benefits, including tax breaks during development, waiver of the submission fees when they come towards licensure, and then potentially they get exclusivity once approved. And so that's a significant benefit. And the issue is when you have gene therapy vectors, what constitutes a same product and a different product? And you might say, well, how could that be a question? Well, it could be, because you can imagine that obviously it makes pretty good sense that if you have the same vector and 2 different genes, those are different products. But what if you have the same gene but 2 different vectors? Is that the same product? And this guidance talks about the fact that, at least for FDA, we consider those 2 different products As long as there's significant differences in the vectors from one another, even two vectors that are different, for instance, from two different viral classes or two different viral serotypes with the same insert would be considered different products. And the reason why I say it's really interesting after your last question is because we feel like rather than preventing innovation, that actually facilitates innovation, because you can imagine that one might have certain benefits over the other in terms of either efficacy or safety. And that will allow more competition in this area. And ultimately, I think it helps in the area that we were just talking about for pricing. So that's a draft guidance. It's open for comment, and people are welcome to comment on that to the docket, which is open now. And we'll see what those comments that come back are, and then there'll be a final guidance that'll be issued in the future. But to us, this is an area where there's a lot evolving. To the extent that we can provide some framework here, some structure, and some clarity about what we'll consider the same and different, we hope that'll help things.
Thank you. On the topic of guidances, given that the field is moving so rapidly, is CBER prepared to perhaps draft more guidelines more rapidly in the future, say the next 2 to 3 years as the field advances? Will there be a need for more guidances and for you all to be ready to draft them relatively quickly?
Yes and yes. So the answer is there will be a need for more guidances. We are already in the process of moving ahead with additional guidances that will come out. Some are on our draft guidance agenda. Some will be in response to needs as they are emerging. And I think that the key piece here that you hit upon is that we understand that the lifetime of these guidances is much shorter than guidances might have been in the past for small molecule drugs or even monoclonal antibodies. And so we're going to have to prepare to really keep up with updating these guidances on a pretty regular basis. I think we have our work cut out for us here, but to me, it's wonderful work to have to do because it shows how fast the science is advancing, how fast, hopefully, the technology will advance to bring these medical benefits to patients.
Well, this brings us to the end of our conversation. Dr. Marks, thank you very much for your insights and comments. For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.